This week on Behind the Lens, it's a war. That comment from a top New Orleans jail official. New testing shows widespread infections at the jail. Meet the COVID slide, a real problem for educators and school kids as they settle in for a long summer. The governor's extension of stay-at-home restrictions through mid-May. We'll look at some of the reaction in a state political discussion as leadership grapples with the COVID-19 crisis. What will it take to reopen, finally and safely? Our health reporter chimes in, and we'll talk with two veteran musicians about the impact of this crisis on live performers in New Orleans. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. We welcome listeners on our partner radio stations, 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WAMF LP, New Orleans. The compliance director at the New Orleans jail has spoken with the Lens criminal justice reporter about his decision to expand inmate testing there. He also talked about the challenges of keeping a deadly infection in check in such a confined environment. Reporter Nick Krastel has the latest on a worrisome situation at the jail.
I talked to Darnley Hodge, who is the jail's compliance director. He's in charge of day-to-day operations of the jail. He took over that authority from Sheriff Marlon Gussman back in 2016 as part of the federal consent decree that the jail is under right now. So I was able to talk to Hodge about what the jail is doing to try and mitigate the spread of coronavirus inside.
And they've clearly done a lot to boost testing levels within the jail. What are the numbers that you've seen as of late?
So the numbers today are they have tested a total of 706 inmates. 125 of them have tested positive, 559 of them have tested negative, and there are 22 test results pending. Of those 125 positives, there are currently 88 in the jail. So a handful of those positive inmates were released at some point.
How many are showing or how many were at last report showing symptoms of the coronavirus?
So that's not something that the jail is regularly reporting, but a spokesperson for the sheriff's office told me that under five of the inmates who tested positive are showing symptoms. So he said that four of them were showing symptoms, and there was another inmate who had tested positive, and it was unclear if he was sick, but it was unclear if it was a result of the virus or other pre-existing conditions that he had. So a very, very small percentage, according to the sheriff's office, are showing symptoms.
The compliance officer talked to you in detail about the decision to really invigorate the testing program there at the jail. Share what he had to say on that topic, Nick.
Yeah, so Hodge said that initially he had been advised, and he wouldn't tell me who advised him, not to implement mass testing, so not to test inmates who weren't showing symptoms. So he said that for about 3 weeks, they weren't doing that. So early on as the virus was spreading, both in the community, and then there also were kind of the first tests coming back for symptomatic inmates and symptomatic staff of the sheriff's office and of the jail that were coming back positive. So he started getting these initial results, and he said about 3 weeks after he was initially advised not to do mass testing, he changed his mind and went against that advice and started acquiring the tests to to test the whole whole jail population and the entire staff.
The early talk about the at least the option that some jailers across the state were considering, and that's sending some of their inmates to Camp J at Angola to relieve some of the crowding at their own jails. But that's not really something that Orleans is doing at this, even at this point.
No, Hodge said that right now they don't have any plans to move inmates to Angola. And, you know, he said they wouldn't rule it out. But he said that would depend on the numbers. And, you know, right now they have 125 prisoners who have inmates who have tested positive. And they're really, you know, I think there's under 100 left to be tested. So it's hard to see, unless the virus continues to spread behind bars, and they start seeing a lot more cases. It doesn't seem like that's going to be an option that they utilize in New Orleans. Obviously, things can change, and if they do, we'll try and keep an eye on that. But right now, they are not planning on transferring inmates to Camp J.
One more story I might ask you about, if you have a minute, is the informational checkpoint strategy the NOPD had been employing as of late.
So the NOPD last week, I believe last Monday, announced that they were going to start doing these checkpoints where they would check seatbelt usage in cars, and they would check seatbelt usage of passengers in cars, and then also use those to inform people about the mayor's stay-at-home order. So yesterday, I got word from a spokesperson at the NOPD that those checkpoints are going to stop. Initially, they had planned to do them throughout the stay-at-home order, which goes to May 16th. But they said that due to restrictions lifting in neighboring parishes, they would be stopping those. They didn't elaborate much on what their reasoning was beyond that.
Nick Krastel on Criminal Justice Affairs. Nick, thanks again for your help.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Several states, Louisiana included, have closed their schools until the end of the academic year. That leaves some students out of classrooms for 5 months or more. The worry, as Marta Jusen explains, is that many of these children may fall behind.
So I think we're all familiar with the summer slide, you know, student learning regression during the summer, just because they're not being as active in their academic settings or, you know, literally in classrooms. The COVID slide is a research paper from the Northwest Evaluation Association. And essentially what these researchers did is they walked back that summer slide based on data that they have all the way to March 15th when school started closing. So what they're saying is we could be seeing a much bigger learning loss in students when they come back in the fall.
And we're talking reading and math categories in particular?
Correct. That's what they examined.
What kind of losses are we talking about?
They're concerned that we could see, basically, they did it on what type of how much knowledge you would retain. And so they think that students coming back would have retained 70% of the typical gains that they would have in reading. And they're concerned that that could be as low as 50% of what their typical learning gains would have been in math when they return in the fall.
So what in particular are some of the factors behind the summer slide that we've talked about in the past, and why that would be especially bad given the stay-at-home orders, the closure of schools, et cetera?
During most summer slides, or I guess your typical summer slide, it's just, you know, we have students out of class, they're not doing exercises. And while, you know, they might be reading, they're probably less likely to be, you know, practicing and advancing their math skills. So during summers, we typically see a bigger academic regression in math versus reading. And what is making this different, and the researchers want to be clear about this, COVID's very different than a typical summer. So we can't necessarily draw the same exact conclusions, but they think this will be helpful in you know, preparing schools for the fall. What's really exacerbating the situation here is that, you know, we have added levels of trauma. We have students and families who are facing job loss and food insecurity. And we know those are things that happen typically for our students, but, you know, now they're happening to a greater number of our students. And the other thing that could be, you know, expanding this inequality that we already have is technology and access to it. We know the district here purchased 10,000 laptops and 8,000 hotspots to give out to students. But I think there are concerns that still didn't cover the gap to make sure that all students could participate in remote learning.
You've also done a bit of reporting this week on the economic picture for the schools themselves and whether or not some of these schools will be able to take advantage of some of the payroll protection measures from the federal government.
It's a really interesting situation because charter schools actually, as nonprofits, are eligible for this funding mechanism that is coming out of the Small Business Administration. It's called the Payroll Protection Program. That's really unique for a school because, you know, normally schools are public entities and they wouldn't, you know, traditional schools are not eligible for these loans that could be forgivable and very helpful in this situation. So we have a handful of charters that have applied for and were approved to receive these. We also have a couple charter networks, the bigger players in town, KIPP and Inspire NOLA, that have too many employees to qualify for them. So I found that interesting. But we do have a handful of networks that are going to be able to utilize or are going to be utilizing this program to pay employee salaries. I do think we could see some controversy in folks, you know, somehow thinking that the schools are double dipping because they're also still getting money from the per pupil funding and state funding. But a few school leaders I talked to, you know, said this is really about preserving the economic future of the school.
You're reporting on that matter at thelensnola.org. Marta Jusen reporting on education matters and certainly how they're impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. Marta, thank you so much and stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
More clear indication this week of the financial hit the city will take amid the coronavirus crisis. Mayor LaToya Cantrell says she will ask to borrow $100 million to cover the anticipated budget gap from this emergency. Meantime, closures at First and Second City Court in New Orleans mean a little relief for some renters. The courts will remain closed until at least May 18th, and that means all eviction proceedings remain on hold. Details on those items are online at thelensnola.org. Governor Edwards' extension of stay-home orders until mid-May was a disappointment for some Louisianans, and he faced no small amount of criticism from state lawmakers of the opposite party. But it was a Republican president who gave this Democratic governor a boost earlier this week. We spoke with two keen observers of state politics. Daniel Erspammer is CEO of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy, and Mary Patricia Ray, Governor Edwards' former communications director and founder of the government relations firm Top Drawer Strategies. Start with the governor's trip to Washington, this being the 29th of April, meeting with President Trump. The governor's office praised the federal commitment to provide some 200,000 tests a month to Louisiana, called that the sort of aid that will be sufficient to allow a phased reopening, perhaps in mid-May. Mary Patricia, I'd like to go to you first for your thoughts.
Well, I mean, the biggest product coming out of that meeting is a Trump safety net
for Governor Edwards, who, of course, is the only Democratic governor in the deep red South. And he's walking out with a little bit of cover for whatever he has already done and what he will probably continue to do in terms of a cautious reopening amidst a lot of criticism from state Republicans, right or wrong. Now they've got to decide how they're going to carefully message so that they don't sound as if they're criticizing their own president. So maybe a little bit of political opportunism for everybody involved in today's Oval Office meeting. But, you know, that's nothing new in America.
I agree in large part with Mary Patricia. I think a lot of this is political theater, which you would probably expect in these kinds of situations. And look, at the end of the day, good coordination between state and federal authorities is a good thing. But of course, as governors and leaders from around the states continue to remind the American public, federalism is an important concept. The states created the federal government and not the other way around. So, you know, this is still going to be a decision and a pathway charted by our state leaders, and having some support from the federal government in terms of tests and other things certainly should help that along. But at the end of the day, we've got to make our decisions here in Louisiana.
Let's talk about the extension. Of course, the governor this week announcing he would extend the stay-at-home orders through May 15th with some notable changes. Daniel, were you hoping for an earlier open?
Absolutely. You know, the numbers are just staggering and heartbreaking when you look at the impact the shelter-in-place order has had on working families across Louisiana. We've now had more than 400,000 people apply for unemployment. Recent estimate of the current unemployment rate here in Louisiana is north of 27%, which outpaces even the worst of the Great Depression. Obviously, that's just an estimate. We'll see as official numbers continue to roll out. And we're talking about every single day the economy remains shuttered is another day that working families have to figure out how to put food on the table, how to keep a roof over their heads. And we're talking 2-week extension is a whole other pay period. So obviously, we all want safe return. We all want to protect everyone's health. But we have to treat this with the situation it is, which is a dual crisis, a health crisis and a crisis for jobs and working families.
Well, I think everybody involved in these decisions doesn't want a cure that's worse than the illness. I think that the reason people come to different conclusions about whether the cure being prescribed is worse than the illness is that they're kind of unwilling to agree on how we got where we are. And I mean that to say that our state had some particularly bad vulnerability economically and health-wise to the impact of COVID-19. And, you know, I'm sure Daniel would identify different vulnerabilities than I would, but having, you know, no living wage, the most unequal pay in the nation, the highest incarceration rate in the nation, the most inequitable health outcomes in the nation, that set us up for a really big vulnerability when it came to this virus. And I think if we're trying to cure what ails us right now in this moment, identifying some of those vulnerabilities and acknowledging them is important. And 2 more weeks to protect against those vulnerabilities for many people seems incredibly reasonable. And I think that the economic impact of this and the solutions for that that are going to come afterwards had better address all of these things and not just corporate tax rates and other politically opportunistic ideas like pension obligation bonds and the like that I hear being tossed around, which were the same ideas people had before this started, and they're not going to fix it. So I guess the long answer to that is I trust that people are watching people in charge are watching this data and thinking about our health because we can't go to work if we aren't alive. I spent 10 days on a ventilator myself
with a respiratory disease much like COVID-19. I had SARS in 2004. And I can tell you that if you've ever seen a loved one on a ventilator, you just have a different viewpoint, a very different viewpoint on what's too long to wait to go back to work.
Look, I think Mary Patricia acknowledges a number of the vulnerabilities that I would absolutely agree with. The problem is the solutions that that she and I come to are very different. The best pathway to solving not only many of our current ills, but also the ones that plagued us before, which she's absolutely right, is an economy that is friendly to job creation, that helps working families come together to create a pathway for them and their future. This is about communities coming together to help one another. So the idea that a number of the things many of us were debating and talking about before the health crisis are somehow at odds with addressing the very challenges that we're facing now is crazy. Those are the same things we all want to address. And look, I'm so grateful Mayor Patricia and I have talked about briefly in passing some of health struggles with that she just referenced. And, you know, thank God she's healthy and has a family. And a lot of the technology and a lot of the solutions to the health crisis are going to emerge from innovators and entrepreneurs and things that we can't even imagine. We've seen some of it already, even in a limited economic activity. Unleashing the power of communities and entrepreneurs and thought leaders and innovators is the way we make sure we get out of both the health and economic crises that we're facing today and make it better so we don't have to do it again next time.
Given the move by, or at least the discussions reported by our partners at The Advocate about some Republican state lawmakers, what the Advocate calls an historical effort by a cadre of conservative Republican legislators to overturn the governor's expected two-week extension. Does this bode well for a state lawmaking body that is going to have to deal with some of the absolute worst revenues in our state history?
The criticism from the legislature is a double-edged sword. You know, the governor could have some problems of his own in dealing with this, politically speaking, in dealing with this crisis. And when the legislature or his friend Jeff Landry or others pick a fight with him, in general, the story becomes about the fight instead of what's being fought over. And, you know, both sides of this little war are going to do what they think is best. But in the end, the governor's most powerful quiver in this instance is you break it, you buy it. There's talk about overriding his executive order, and most legislators I speak with about it are unwilling to do it because we would lose a massive amount of federal funds if we embarked down that path. And, you know, in the end, money walks and you know what talks. So I think, you know, there's plenty of reasons that the legislature is actually degrading itself when it spends all of its time criticizing the governor instead of proposing solutions and just trying to get back to work. I think there are some legislators that are trying to do that. But, you know, you've got a lame duck governor. Picking a fight with him might feel good politically, but in the end, in terms of results, with an almost supermajority Republican legislature, you can already basically do what you want anyway. So it's kind of just for show.
You know, first of all, the idea that this is just sort of one-way street of criticism, that Republican lawmakers are, you know, sort of going out of bounds to criticize this governor, it's crazy. When you look and see political operatives and others in the governor's orbit on Twitter and other social media going pretty hard after members of the legislature on a variety of things related to this crisis, look, there's enough political opportunism, as we talked about earlier, to go around here. And while certainly there are some folks who have been pretty aggressive against the governor, most of the legislators with whom I'm speaking are speaking out for a few reasons. It's not about criticizing this governor. It's about speaking about the truth here. It's about making a point of view that the social media mobs and others who have been driving the shelter in place just have a refusal to have any engagement or debate all too often from other points of view on this. And, you know, most of the folks I'm speaking with are hearing every single day from their constituents saying you have to do something. Not only are we suffering a health crisis, but we're suffering terribly in not being able to go to work, not being able to create food on the table and have a roof over our heads. So what's a legislator to do? If you're hearing from your constituents and you believe very strongly that the government is going down the wrong path, it's your duty to speak out. It's your duty to explore how do we solve both of these. The idea that to solve one crisis, you have to give up on the other is pure folly. It's putting all of our energy into solving both of these crises together that's going to get us out the other side. I'm thrilled to see debate going on in the public square. I wish it was tinged with a little less political opportunism from time to time. But the only way we get through this is by doing what we're doing right now, which is taking different points of view, debating them, discussing them, and coming to the other side. There's been too little of that. Everybody who has tried to speak a different point of view gets immediately attacked from the other side. That's just not how we get through this together.
Yeah, and I have to agree with Daniel on some of these points and that criticism is due where it's due. We likely have a lot more in common than we know in terms of what solutions that the two sides, so to speak, would be willing to agree upon. But, I don't think the response from either the governor's camp or the legislature is happening organically. I don't think this is something that's happening because legislators are hearing from their constituents. The same way that Daniel cited the governor's camp being highly critical, really on some personal issues, I think, of some legislators, we got press releases out from the hired consultant to the speaker and the Senate president with quotes like, "We're getting ready to fight a war," and leaking of, memos that tell legislators what not to say about this in order to shape the narrative. So it's pretty WWE, except for the end results and whether or not there's a big backlash to some of this really scripted political rhetoric is big or small, and who comes out in the end with the worst reputation. We don't know the answer to that yet, but we can kind of see the writing on the wall in terms of like who's going to come into the ring and what kind of smack they're going to talk. And that's frustrating to a lot of people because they just want to see solutions.
I certainly agree, Mary Patricia, with breaking news, right? Politicians engage in politics. I think we all expect that. I will say this: the idea or the notion that legislators are not hearing from their constituents on this is just flat out wrong. I talk to them every day, not only the lawmakers, I know you do too. Not only the lawmakers, but their constituents themselves. There is a tremendous amount of frustration, and people are taking action on it. And it's not just the fringes that you see on TV. Real people all across the state who are struggling are reaching out to their constituents. The idea that this is all political theater, I don't think that's quite right. There certainly is, and that's what's going to get coverage. But people out across the state are speaking up, and it's important that their elected officials listen.
I certainly don't want to leave the state's congressional delegation out of the discussion either. But I would ask the partisan divisions on the national level and presidential campaign dynamics in particular. What is their impact on the ability for state leadership to tackle these politics and governance issues in the middle of this pandemic?
Well, look, our legislative delegation is very skilled at working together when they have to. And I think even more skilled at looking like they're working together, even if they aren't. They have, it's mostly Republicans, but they tend to include their colleague who is not a Republican very frequently in their work. And I think they do a great job of that. We are a taker state. You know, I mean, we put less in than we get back. Frankly, we have opportunities to draw down even more federal funds that we miss every year. But it goes without saying that, like, you know, in these packages of bills that are being passed where we're going to get all these funds trickling down apparently to businesses and individuals and government, we're one of the states who's probably going to get more than we give. And we need a legislative delegation who will continue to fight for that and continue to fight rhetoric from inside the Republican Party and everywhere that indicates that that's not fair or not right or not just. And I know that our delegation will do it. They do it after every flood, every hurricane. This is really nothing new for us in terms of fighting for federal funding. And I know they're going to work hard to get as much as they can. And they have a lot of hard work to do because they have to contend with the politics of the day, a president that we never know what he's going to say or when he's going to say it, and frankly, a governor who tends to appeal to the middle. So they've got to try to stay in tune with all that, sing from the same book, and get as many of these federal dollars as they can. There's probably no other state that has a more skilled delegation when it comes to advocating for federal funding. And I'm excited to see what they're able to do. And I think it's a true point of optimism for Louisiana at this point when we really need some.
I have to chuckle at that. This idea that there's a magic money tree in Washington, D.C. that just throws money into the ether and it falls in Louisiana. This is our tax money, too. This is coming from you and me and, as Mary Patricia rightly points out, our neighbors in Texas and California and Tennessee and all over the country. We should have the same skepticism and the same wish for prudence and frugality we have with every single one of our personal dollars or the dollars we spend to Baton Rouge. We should have the same feeling toward the money we're sending to Washington, D.C. And add to that, you know, as Mayor Patricia again rightly points out, because this isn't a flood or a hurricane or something that Louisiana is facing alone, demand on our federal tax dollars to be deployed to solve these crises are going to be shared in every corner of the state. The pathway to recovery, the pathway to success and health and economic growth and opportunity for every single Louisianan is to get our policies right, to make sure we can be friendly to those seeking to build an enterprise and friendly to those looking for work and for communities, nonprofits, churches, the civil society sector to come together to really help people who are in need. That's what America's built on. So without a doubt, there's already been federal dollars flowing in. There will continue to be. I would argue we should continue to be skeptical of those. They come with strings attached. They cause they may help in the short term, and no one's going to deny that. But the long-term challenge, if we're not set up to do this right, could be a real challenge we're going to be struggling with in the years to come.
We leave it there for now. Daniel Erspommer, Pelican Institute for Public Policy, and Mary Patricia Ray with Top Drawer Strategies. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for your coverage at The Lens. It's really important, and you guys are doing a yeoman's job, so keep it up and stay safe.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Mary Patricia, always good to talk. We'll get to see each other
yes,
soon.
Sir. See you soon.
After the break, Leslie Carde on the lingering questions of COVID-19 spread and a bittersweet reunion of sorts of two longtime bandmates. It's a lot harder to practice in the middle of a pandemic. You're listening to Behind the Lens on podcast app, on our website, or on one of our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 WHIV LP New Orleans. And now, a word from Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, U.S. Army retired, founder, Green Army.
Louisiana, listen up. We have to be safe. Some of the key aspects of being safe during this COVID pandemic is to do the following. Wash your hands. Keep washing those hands. Kill the virus. Point two, wear a mask. When you go out, keep your social distance and stay home. Particularly to the vulnerable population. You know who we are. I'm one of them. Stay home. Find somebody else to do it. Stay home. Stay out of the public. Protect yourself. Protect your family. We'll get through this, but we all need to do the sacrifice it takes to make it happen. God bless you. Stay home. Wear a mask. Wash your hand. Vulnerable population. Stay off the streets. God bless you.
I'm Karen Gadbois, founder and director at The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana. The business of journalism is important and crucial, and all our staff is working hard to bring you accurate and vital reporting. But we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website, thelensnola.org/donate. And remember, stay home, stay informed. We thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens, NOLA.org. I'm Tom Wright. We've become aware of just how much we don't know. That quote from a report by health correspondent Leslie Carday sums up the mysteries that COVID-19 has thrown into the lap of researchers and policymakers. As pressure grows to reopen commerce and society in general, explanations remain elusive. We spoke with Leslie Friday morning. I've read this report or the synopsis of this new report from Harvard researchers on the links between COVID-19 morbidity rates and air pollution. Why don't you pick it up from there, Leslie?
Yeah, it was a little scary reading it because Harvard actually went through the United States state by state and county by county, or in our case, parish by parish, and determined that just a slight increase in air pollution can be the double whammy in terms of affecting your lungs so that they can't respond positively to the coronavirus. So they looked at, we particularly have problems in places like St. John the Baptist Parish, St. James Parish, and what's the common denominator? That would be chemical plants. So in looking at everything and going for particulate matter, which is the microscopic dust that you can't see in the air, but which you inhale and gets into your lungs and slowly but surely destroys your lungs, that's what we're concerned about. Not large particles, because large particles can be coughed up, but these cannot. So it's kind of the silent, deadly killer that exists in the air. And as we all know, the administration currently in office has rolled back and dialed back a lot of the EPA regulations. So now plants are freewheeling out there and figuring this is the place to come, especially in Louisiana, where our regulations are much less stringent than they are, let's say, in California. So we've had in 2019, three new chemical plants come online in St. James Parish, which is a little frightening because they already are at the top of the curve. So what we've learned from all of this is that although we always knew that poor air quality affected humans in the sense of creating more problems with asthma and COPD, we weren't really thinking of it in terms of infectious diseases and the fact that it impairs us and our ability to fight off a virus, for instance, in this case, COVID-19, that attacks the lungs. So it was a very interesting story. And a woman here at Tulane analyzed just the data from Louisiana. So she broke it down even further than Harvard did, wanting to know how that study impacted us here in the state.
Right. Kim Terrell, right?
Correct. Kim Terrell. Exactly. So, you know, it's been an interesting study. It's gone now for peer review to the New England Journal of Medicine. But I think the one big takeaway is that air quality affects us deleteriously in many more ways than we even thought about previously. And this is just confirmed all of that.
They're finding a direct correlation between air pollution, particulate matter levels in the air, and COVID-19 morbidity.
Yes, actual deaths. In fact, they list them. St. James Parish has five times the deaths per every 10,000 people than you would see in a much larger city like New Orleans. you know, in Orleans Parish. So you can see there's a direct correlation between what people are breathing in. This is not a surprise to probably anybody in Louisiana, who, especially people who live underneath those chemical areas, who've been complaining nonstop for years about the quality of their air. So it just confirms a lot of what we thought might be a problem is even a much worse problem.
Just looking at, you know, some of the questions that are left hanging over us, health officials, authorities alike, about, you know, what happens when we finally reopen society, you know, with so many factors and so many cases of coronavirus infection still with us. You know, what were you finding in your reporting this week?
Well, you know, first of all, I think we all need to consider that many of these states which are reopening haven't met CDC guidelines of having 14 straight days of lessening cases. So that's number one, which is why Governor John Bel Edwards did not decide to open on May 1st everything. So, but beyond that, I think we need to also realize the unknowns that are out there. We still don't have any idea if you have antibodies, and I'll preface that by saying that we don't even have enough tests to do antibody testing on most people. But if you do have antibodies, what that really means, the World Health Organization had to walk back a statement they made earlier in the week, which said absolutely having antibodies doesn't mean a patient has acquired any immunity. Then they reversed it and said, well, let's put it this way. If you've been infected and you have developed antibodies, you probably have some level of protection. But you see how people are confused. Going on from that statement, I talked to some of the infectious disease people at Tulane, and they were saying that there are different kinds of immunity, too. You can have cellular immunity, which is where your own system kicks in and your white blood cells are gobbling up the virus. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the antibody component we're all talking about that may protect you for any place from 6 months to a year and a half. And then we have the whole question of, what sorts of antibodies do you have? It seems that the people who've gotten sickest and were on ventilators, when their blood is analyzed and plasmapheresis for antibodies, it turns out they have much better antibodies, even though their out-of-control immune responses at the time they were sick almost killed them. So there is a lot going on here. We still don't know about children. Initially, we thought children weren't really coming down with it. Now they think they're probably mostly asymptomatic. And then we've had a couple of deaths with children in this country. So there's a lot of confusion, Tom, about just what's going on and how far this disease can go. The emergency department chief in New York at New York Press, who took her life last weekend, they think had severe brain changes after she came down with COVID-19, recovered, and went back into the emergency room, then sort of went into a mental health funk, became very depressed, and took her own life last weekend. Her own sister said she's ordered an autopsy of her brain because she thinks that COVID-19 substantially changed the molecular structure of her brain. So we have a lot of unanswered questions here. And indeed, many of the infectious disease people have said they're seeing more and more neurological repercussions of COVID-19, like meningitis and encephalitis. So we just don't know a lot at this point. Until we get more data, it's hard to know what to expect. And with the communities going back into the workplace and out into retail stores, who knows what's going to happen?
Leslie Carde, reporting on the health and medical beat. Leslie, thank you again.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Jazz Festing in Place continued this weekend on WWOZ, and all those archival recordings have come in handy for listeners, but for some of the musicians who have played Jazz Fest in years past, there are also reminders of shows canceled, postponed until further notice. We wanted to take time and hear from some of those musicians and how they're being impacted by the pandemic. Kevin O'Quinn is a veteran drummer whose many bands include Big Sun, the Cajun Drifters, Bayou DeVille. We are, in fact, talking about the one-time manager of famous Tower Records in New Orleans. He's a longtime collaborator with Joe Tullis, a singer-songwriter, and recording artist who's worked with members of the Radiators, Blind Melon, and Squirrel Knot Zippers. They are playing together again, when time and pandemic allow, in a recording project called the River Road Collective.
My name is Joseph Tullis. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. I was raised in Laplace, Louisiana. And now I'm back in New Orleans, Louisiana.
My name is Kevin Aucoin, and it is spelled A-U-C-O-I-N, for those of you who aren't from South Louisiana.
It's Aucoin.
Born and raised in the same area as Joe Tullis, St. John the Baptist Parish, Reserve, Louisiana.
God's country.
And have been in New Orleans most of my adult life.
I met you when I was 13 years old. I mean, we've been doing it our whole lives. We didn't really do anything else. And at least, you know, in my family, it seemed to be a totally okay profession to be a musician, where other people, like if you were like a lawyer or a judge, people would make fun of you in my family. But if you could play music, then you were okay. But, you know, but I met, you know, Kevin, you were working with Audio Innovations, right? When I met you. And but, yeah, making records nowadays, it's like, you know, you have to make them because you love to make them. It's not because, you know, anybody can buy one record and just download it and burn it for all their friends and it's kind of done. So, you know, we at least, you know, most of the stuff is online now. You know, I don't really even know how to buy a record anymore. Do you?
Well, I think it's a generational thing, too. We've all bought vinyl. We've all bought cassettes. We probably, some of us, have even bought 8-tracks. And, of course, CDs and DVDs and everything else. Anyway, I think the new generation is missing that. And that's one reason why I'm not in the record retail business anymore, because all of those stores are now gone.
Well, the only thing I'm interested in putting out right now is really only to actually sell like a physical item would only be on vinyl. And the rest of it, they can download it off the internet if that's what they want to do. They can go to iTunes or whatever. But to me, it's like, you know, I miss the days when you could actually get a record album with the lyric sheets, we'd actually read them. You know, you get a
and
CD.
Artwork.
If you're going to pay that kind of money for something, I think you ought to get some value for your money. There's something about being a kid and being able to lay in your bed and put on a piece of vinyl and look at the lyrics and read it. I mean, yeah, you could get it online on your computer. That's true. You know, you could do that. But there's just something about having to read it yourself.
Regardless of all that we've just talked about, people are still, music is still music. Music is still a way of life. If it wasn't for music, God help us right now. You know, if we didn't have music, I know everyone's been going online doing things and performing. It's been great. They've been performances that have helped fellow musicians like myself financially. So yeah, it's a great thing, and it always has been a great thing, especially in this city.
Yeah, but you're a working musician.
I am a songwriter.
So I mean,
yes.
It's like, so what's happened to you?
So yes, I am a full-time musician. I have been for probably the last 20 plus years, performing the last 15 plus years, 6 nights a week average, sometimes 7 nights a week, sometimes 10, 12 gigs a week.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, yeah.
Well, and I believe
there, there are those times, and there are lucrative times, especially the time that we're in right now with Jazz Fest, French Quarter Fest. This is a big time for all the local musicians and artists and restaurants and everybody, ballrooms, everybody, live music venues. This is our Christmas, as we all know. And we're missing it, unfortunately.
It's kind of a strange thing. I understand it, but you know, people think that entertainment is not necessary, but I think it is. You just can't get too close to each other, right?
Well, we'll figure out a way to make this all work in the long run. I have faith, actually, in our government to a certain extent that will make something happen to where we'll all be able to go out and socialize again. I don't think it's going to be in the near future, but besides that.
Well, it's a very social town. New Orleans has always been that way. And you and I have both been around. All of us have been around quite a bit, you know. But it's like, as far as like being social with each other, we always hug each other, kiss each other. It's like, you know, it's very, I think a little bit more. I was just talking to some of my friends in Montana where they don't even see their even neighbors for months, you know. I mean, but, you know, New Orleans just isn't that way. So I think it's been a little bit different.
Drop my jerseys in the salt bucket. Safest smiles can be. Views of you in the soul bucket on Island TV. Blow your kisses to the soul bucket. I catch him wait and then.
together for probably 30 of those 40 years.
Yeah.
We were Americana before Americana came out, to be honest with you.
Because we didn't know any better.
Big Son, we were doing what eventually became Americana music.
Yeah, but we didn't know any better.
And it was still very rock-tinged also, but you know.
We thought we were in a rock band.
You look at people like back in the 90s, like Counting Crows and even Tom Petty for that fact.
And well, I remember like with the Subdudes, you and I were playing Jazz Fest, right? And with Big Son. And I'm the only person in New Orleans who even owned a mandolin. It was the only one in town. So the Subdudes go, "Hey man, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I gotta go play, you know." And they go, "Okay, cool." Cause it was like a family reunion and all the bands, cause most of them are touring most of the time. But Jazz Fest, everybody comes back home, right? And so it's all big hugs and kisses, which I guess I would do it, but they probably wouldn't. But they go, "Hey, we got this song called Message Man. It's like, would you come?" And it's like, "Well, if you want me to." I mean, it's like, you know, I own a mandolin. I only knew like three chords on it. Luckily, there's only three chords to the song. So, but they, you know, at the time, the Subdudes, and probably still are, you know, it was just the big ticket. You know, I'm sitting there with the mandolin playing Message Man. But it was Americana, too, because we all came from the St. John the Baptist Parish.
If you were a bluegrass band or something like that, yeah, you had a
blow. Oh, I'm not no picker, but I could play the chords, you know.
Once they shut down the state, I was saying earlier in our conversation before starting this interview process, is that I had a great birthday this year because the state was shut down on my birthday, March 16th. And that's when we had everything come to an end. All the bars closed, the restaurants closed, all of my gigs closed. So it's since that time I have not been able to work. So immediately, I knew that there were going to be organizations looking to support musicians. One, the first one that came to my mind was Music Cares, which is run by the Grammy organization. And they helped me tremendously after Hurricane Katrina and helped a lot of musicians in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. But this was a different animal. This was them now trying to help the entire United States. And they've done a great job. They've done a great, great job. So I started filling out applications as soon as they came online, gathering all my financial information, and applying for as many grants as I could possibly apply for, knowing that I was going to basically have no income coming in for the unforeseeable future. Considering that I really deep down in my gut feel like ballrooms are going to be probably one of the last places to open after this is all said and done, and half of my gigs are in a bar, the other half's at a restaurant. That's not to say that the restaurant might open, but then tell a band, look, we really got to cut back on things because they're not going to be as busy as they normally are. So they might eliminate the music until they can get back on their feet because they've been closed. Of course, you have a lot of musicians that the summertime is their big season, because they're touring all over the world. All of that got shut down. Now, of course, when you're touring, usually you do pretty good financially. So you've got major artists and semi-national artists that are really hurting right now.
Well, they get all the festivals and everything else in it that all got yanked out from, you know, we're making this record with David Malone, you know, from the Radiators. They even, I mean, that this is a big time of year for all these guys. Right. And it's like, and it's gone. You know, and by the way, it's not just here in New Orleans, it's everywhere.
And that's why you're seeing a lot of these national megastars come on TV and do these benefits and all. I mean, those guys aren't going to hurt. I mean, yeah, they're losing revenue because they're not touring, and a lot of them had major tours, and especially major artists like Elton John and, you know, those kind of people, you know, they're killing it when they tour. So basically they're losing that, but of course, they're Elton John. And so they can afford to donate $100,000 to this charitable event or to the Music Cares Foundation or whatever. So there's lots of positives. And as you hear a lot, not only in New Orleans, but now internationally, you know, it's still that music to me. The music is what keeps us all together. You know, if we didn't have something to fall back on, to turn on our TV at night and hear Elton John and whoever else on TV, or to turn on our computer and see, you know, Tommy Malone or John Cleary or any of these local New Orleans artists, you know, getting up there and playing from their living rooms or their balconies, you know, that's what keeps us all alive, really. Joe and I thought about doing some things. I know Joe did something on his own the other day, I saw.
Well, she did.
But I told him I didn't want to be in the same room as him while this was going on.
Yeah, I know.
So,
because he thinks I'm going to get him diseased and whatnot. Things have gotten so desperate, especially like, you know, me and Andrea are living in a CBD right now, and Kevin's over here in a quarter. You know, it's horrible for a lot of people, but it's also, I'm sorry, but it's just great songwriting fodder to see when things break down this way. They're right in front of your face every morning. It's like, you know, these poor people, it's like, you know, you go out and get, you know, we have some extra blankets go give them to people because they're sleeping on the streets. And it's, you know, it's, let's put it this way, I'm staying busy. You know, I always write everything in my head. I never really ever sit down with a guitar and go, I think I need to write a song today. They just come to me and that's just the way it goes. So, but when you're walking around, it's sort of like having a big trawling boat. You know, you walk outside emotionally and you have like, you know, you're picking up fish every day. Eventually you throw them on the deck and see what you have, you know, and what are you going to write about? What's important? You know, and these things, they just mean something to me. You know, I'm a songwriter. I will say this about this town, and my family's been here for almost 300 years. You know, if they're the most resilient people ever, if anybody can get through this, we can do this.
Yeah, I agree with Joe, but also have to say that because this is something that's affecting the entire world, after Katrina, you know, yeah, I immediately left and went to my ex-in-laws in New York. Because I was trying to find work, because I knew I could find work there. You can't do that now with this pandemic. Yeah. Everyone's going through the same thing that we're going through. We're all on the same playing field now. The entire world is on the same playing field.
It is absolutely a whole different situation, you know, and I think it's going to last a lot longer than Katrina did.
Our thanks to Joe Tullis, Kevin O'Quinn, and our friends at NewOrleansLocal.com for helping us set up the interview. That's the show for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens. Just think after all these years, his lens are falling upon deaf ears. Now we're drowning into me.